and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. And what we're going to do now is talk about a document that the Sunday Times published yesterday. It was a secret document codenamed Operation Yellowhammer. It came from the British Civil Service, and it paints an appalling vista, if you like, of what will happen when we arrive at October the 31st, and Britain, if it leaves without a deal, will leave the European Union. I'm joined now by Brendan O'Neill, the editor of Spiked Online. Brendan is an ardent Brexiteer, and he, I've no doubt, has seen this document. Brendan, the Sunday Times splashed on this document yesterday. It does, I'm sure you'll agree, paint an alarming picture.
It does. I think the fact that it paints an alarming picture is in itself enough to make me ask questions about where it came from, who leaked it, why they leaked it, and so on. Because since the Sunday Times published that splash and all these horrible stories of things that might happen, and food would run out and drugs could run out and there would be long queues at the border and all these other potential scenarios, quite a few ministers have come forward and said this was a worst case scenario document. Much of it has already been acted upon. So, for example, Gibraltar has come out and said, we've seen this document, we've acted on it, we've taken the precautionary measures. Some people in the Boris government are saying that they've taken action over the since they took power over the past 2 or 3 weeks to counteract some of these potential consequences. And so the discussion now has shifted in two different directions. The first is just how bad will no deal be, and how many of these scenarios are realistic, or how many of them are just imagined scenarios in order to, for Britain to prepare. And then it's gone in another direction too, which is what is going on behind the scenes with former ministers. One of the rumours is that Philip Hammond leaked the document. He denies doing so. And what's going on with the civil service, that they are allowing incredibly sensitive documents to accidentally fall into the hands of a media person in a pub in Westminster. What kind of political games are being played there? So it's actually opened up a very interesting can of worms in terms of the political tensions inside Westminster.
Yeah, now here's one suggestion I would make to you, Brendan, that in fact, there's no doubt that a significant proportion of people in Britain, maybe 45 or 50% even, are fearful now of the no-deal scenario, the crash-out scenario that Johnson has been peddling, and there's no doubt about that, and that these things are credible. For example, I know from our discussions we've had with the Irish Roadholders Association, the problem with ferries and lorries, and one of the facts in this document is that 85% of lorries using the main channel crossings may not be ready for French customs and could face delays of up to 2.5 days. I know that to be the case because it's the same with our own haulage companies here and ferries here, that despite people saying we're ready, most small and medium businesses and an awful lot of farmers who are exporters and the drivers have not prepared and can't prepare. They haven't had the time to prepare, nor have the customs officers become familiar with the documentation. That's entirely credible to me.
Well, the thing is, the thing I would ask is the question of if it's true that there is a lack of preparation and there will be all this disruption at the border and on roads and so on, it immediately raises a question in my mind, which is who would be responsible for that situation? Would it be the fact that people voted for Brexit, which is how Remainers are discussing it? They're saying this proves that Brexit is undoable, it's unworkable, it simply is too destructive for us to pursue. Or would it be the fault of government ministers and a civil service who we know for a fact have purposefully failed to put in place the right preparations for the possibility of a no deal, either because they didn't think no deal would actually happen or because they wanted to create a situation in which a no deal would be completely and utterly undesirable. So the question of whether these things are credible, I think that's open for debate. I mean, there are numerous conflicting arguments being made and reports coming out about the preparedness of the ports. The French have said that British lorries won't be held up and it will flood cross-channel ports with extra staff to ensure that that doesn't happen, for example. So there are conflicting claims of what will happen and how it will happen. But the broader political question, if we're talking about Brexit and the vote and what happens next in relation to Britain's relationship with the EU, is if we are unprepared, how has that come about? And the possibility that it's come about because the political class actively refused to prepare and, in fact, refused to advise small businesses, refused to take the necessary measures that a normal political system would take if it was heading towards unpredictable territory. If that's the case, then I think that speaks to something worse than potential disruption. It speaks to a really sinister streak within the political class, which is using civil service clout to try to weaken a democratic vote.
But the problem with that argument, Brendan, is that Boris Johnson, Priti Patel, Michael Gove, and all of these people are the Tory political system. In other words, I mean, Johnson and Priti Patel voted for Brexit. Gove voted for Theresa May's Brexit. Mm. I think he voted three times for it. Mm. Now, the question really is not about who's to blame, but it's about what is doable in terms of preparation when it's only a few weeks since Johnson declared, got into power and declared that Britain was leaving come hell or high water, come what may. And I suppose here's the question for you as a Brexiteer. Did he make a promise that was feasible, or was he just bullshitting and just blustering? And it does seem from here, really, that it is, you know, buffoonery to talk in this way in order to get into Downing Street, which he succeeded in doing.
I think I don't think we can completely discount what's happened in the 3 years running up to this, because the thing is,
but he was part of it, and the Tories were part of it.
I completely agree. I have incredibly little and shrinking faith in the current Tory government and in the new cabinet, even though it's made up primarily of people who are pro-Brexit or at least sympathetic to Brexit. I don't have much faith in them. These are people who, as you say, voted for Theresa May's withdrawal agreement once or more than once. These are people who were well aware of the blocks that were being put in the way of Brexit, but they were well aware that preparations weren't being made for the potential of a no deal, and they could have done something about it much earlier. So for them to come in this late in the day and say, well, that's it, we're leaving on the 31st of October, no deal, come rain or shine, is, I'm not celebrating that at all. I'm not celebrating that. But I do think alongside that, alongside the questioning of Boris and whether it's reckless for him to say we're out on the 31st of October, whether we're prepared or not, I think it is the question that lots of British people are asking, and this is why there are substantial numbers of people in the country, more than 45%, who think we should leave without a deal if the EU refuses to negotiate anymore. What they are asking is, how did we get into this situation? So, for example, if it's true that British lorries still aren't prepared for the new customs rules and that would lead to excessive delays at the French border, which the French say is not true, but let's say it is true, that immediately raises the question of what the civil service has been doing for 3+ years, what the political class has been doing for 3+ years. And I absolutely agree that completely and utterly includes Boris Johnson, who skulked off to the bank backbenches and who knew that all of this was going on and didn't do anything about it because he thinks primarily of himself and he thinks primarily of his right to be in Downing Street, and that was his overarching aim. But this is what's interesting about the Yellowhammer revelations. Remainers think it's a trump card. They think it's the thing that disproves Brexit and shows that Brexit is a really bad thing. But actually, it's got huge numbers of people saying, hold on, why haven't you prepared? And so as I say, there are two questions right now. One is, why haven't you prepared? What were the sinister motivations for you failing to prepare for what everyone knew was a distinct possibility? I mean, Theresa May was saying no deal is better than a bad deal for years. Everyone knew that no deal was a distinct possibility, and yet they failed to prepare. So that's the first question. And then the second question is, how far can Boris go in terms of making some of these preparations prior to the 31st of October? And those are the two questions occupying British people's minds right now, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that strikes me immediately when you ask that question, Brendan, is that Theresa May appeared happy for Britain to leave the European Union, but stay aligned to the customs union and the single market in Ireland. No problem. Wasn't that the Chequers' proposal?
Yeah, but the problem with Theresa May is that she didn't know what she wanted, and she drew these red lines. They were red lines that I actually would support, which is her red lines were that leaving the European Union means leaving all the institutions of the European Union. And the argument that was made by Theresa May and others very early on is that any European Union institution which at some level interferes with democratic sovereignty, by definition, we have to leave that institution because this is what the people voted for. This is what the people argued for. This was the slogan of take back control and so on and so forth. The problem is she erased her own red lines. She kept shifting. She kept moving around. She reneged on the Tory party's own general election manifesto from 2017 when she tried to get her boosted majority and failed spectacularly. That manifesto said we will leave the single market and the customs union and Brexit must mean Brexit. That's why, for the first time in my life, I voted for the Conservative Party in 2017 on the basis of that manifesto. And I'm sure many other people did as well. And she shifted away from that constantly and then arrived at a situation where, you know, the European Union was saying we need the Irish backstop in case we have to keep Northern Ireland in the customs union and in the single market. And Theresa May's response was, why don't we apply that to the whole of the United Kingdom? So she erased her own red lines and she compromised too much. But the issue is, and you're absolutely right to raise this because it's so fundamental to the current discussion. The fact is that Boris and others in the current cabinet watched her do this and actually supported her. All of them at a certain point voted for her withdrawal agreement. So I'm not saying that I believe them when they say we're committed to Brexit properly, but I do think the question of what's been going on for 3 years is quite key to some of this discussion about no deal and Yellowhammer and so on.
Right. Now, just to come to the Irish dimension to this and the significance of the Democratic Unionist Party and Sammy Wilson, Arlene Foster and these people, isn't it true to say, Brendan, that really if you took them out of the equation and the British government wanted to negotiate a deal with the European Union, there would not be any problem. The sticking point between the European Union and the British government is the backstop. Mm. And the only people who don't want the backstop are the DUP. And the only reason anyone's listening to them is the slender majority Theresa May had and now Boris Johnson has. So here we have a party that, you know, by some measures, and I don't dispute their right to exist, they were against the Good Friday Agreement. Arlene Foster resigned from the Unionist Party because she was against the Good Friday Agreement. Now, they don't want the Good Friday Agreement to operate, but the British government is a signatory and a co-guarantor of this international peace agreement, which is lodged with the United Nations. So where are we here? I mean, I'm a Eurosceptic, as you know. So I totally see the reasons for Britain leaving and accept their right to exist. But I don't accept their right to destroy Ireland. And if yesterday's document is credible, which I think it is, by and large, to destroy many aspects of its own country as well. All because of Sammy Wilson and Arlene Foster, two people who really, if they'd had their way, would still be murdering each other in this island.
Well, you know, I'm not...
What's the relationship between... Take them out. Why not? Why doesn't Johnson, if he wants to do something, take them out?
But the problem with the thing is, in the Westminster circle at the moment, it's not just the DUP who have an issue with the Irish backstop. I mean, the ERG has had an issue with the Irish backstop for a long time.
One of the reasons you've mentioned it to me here, and other people have said, you don't want the UK, and I totally agree with you, to be a vassal state of Europe, correct?
Mm-hmm.
But the same people who don't want the EU to be Britain to be a vassal state of Europe, your friends in the ERG and the DUP, they're quite happy for Ireland to be a vassal state of the UK.
Well, that may be true of some people in the ERG. I have no doubt that some of them see Ireland as an insignificant state, and in fact I'm sure some of them think the island should rejoin the United Kingdom. I'm sure they hold those kinds of I'm sure they hold those kinds of prejudiced views. I wouldn't be surprised at all. You know, these are old toffs and Tories, and they've never been huge fans of Irish independence, or certainly the idea of an Irish Republic. So I'm sure that's true, but concern about the Irish backstop is actually quite widely shared in the UK. So, for example, one of the Theresa May's withdrawal agreement, one of the key issues in it was, of course, the Irish backstop. And her withdrawal agreement was spectacularly unpopular across the United Kingdom. It was unpopular in every single opinion poll, virtually. People just didn't like it. And that goes for Leavers and Remainers. You know, I heard Remainers saying that this is giving away too much sovereignty. And in my view, Remainers are not exactly huge fans of the idea of national sovereignty in the first place, which is why they're so pro-EU. But even some of them were saying, this gives away too much, this could break up the UK and so on. So the issue with the Irish backstop, I do think it goes slightly beyond the DUP. I think the DUP's relationship with the Tories is problematic and has led to a situation where the Conservatives have had to kowtow to the DUP on certain issues. The backstop issue, my unpopular view on the backstop issue is that it's one of the measures that was used by the European Union to try to weaken the case for Brexit itself. It was embraced by Remain-leaning members of Parliament, including Theresa May herself, who became a cheerleader for the backstop at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And as a consequence of all those shifts where people were saying, well, we need the backstop, otherwise everything's going to go to hell in a handbasket, opposition to the backstop did start to grow. And the key argument the Boris government is making right now, and is being applauded relatively widely for making this argument, but its key argument right now is that the EU has to renegotiate the backstop, and the EU is refusing to do that.
Okay, let me move on to Priti Patel. Priti Patel has now said that Britain is going to end free movement of EU citizens on day one of, this is the 1st of November. Is this not mad?
Yeah, I think it is mad.
I mean, these are the people who are now in your government, Brendan. And as I say, we agree about many things, and the undesirability of being in the EU might be one of them. But this is a woman who wants to, who wanted to restore the death penalty. She appears to have backed off this, but she now wants to take this punitive, crazy measure that's going to affect people in the most appalling way. This is where the British government is now at, driven by extremism, really.
Well, one of the mistakes that the political elite has made is that they think the vote for Brexit was entirely about immigration. Now, that mistake, of course, that mistake is made by Remainers. I mean, they're obsessed with this idea that we voted for Brexit because we hate foreigners and we want to raise the drawbridge and all that kind of stuff. Mm. But it's also shared, in fact, by pro-Brexit politicians, and by Theresa May, who wasn't necessarily pro-Brexit, but she ran the country, and she was absolutely convinced that people voted Brexit because they don't like immigration. So she brought in these tough measures, none of which was very popular and none of which got people, you know, excited. So, for example, her withdrawal agreement promised a very swift end to freedom of movement, but it still was a very unpopular document in the country at large because it didn't resolve what I think were the broader questions behind the Brexit vote, which were the questions of sovereignty and the questions of who makes our trade deals, who makes our laws, who controls our borders and so on. So even her document wasn't popular. So if Priti Patel thinks that saying we're going to stop freedom of movement on the very first day, if she thinks that's going to win her the support of, you know, the millions and millions of people who back Brexit, I think she's in for a rude awakening.
Yeah.
The thing is, and this is a complicated argument, and but
we have people, time. That's what's different from that's why people turn off the radio, because they and want to listen to podcasts, because complicated arguments are best made when you have time and space and nobody shouting at you.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And the complicated argument here is that I do think the Brexit vote, one of the reasons was people wanted an end to freedom of movement. So, for example, if you look at the Ashcroft polls that were taken on the day of the vote itself, the number one reason Leave voters gave for voting Leave was because they want British law to be made in British democratic institutions. The second reason was they are concerned about freedom of movement. But even when people say we want an end to freedom of movement, what they mean is freedom of movement mandated by the European Union, so kind of beyond the reach of ordinary British voters. And they want those questions, the question of immigration and where immigrants should come from and how many we should have, they want those questions brought back to British political life. That's why, for example, a third of Asian voters voted for Brexit, because they're concerned about the unfairness of the immigration system under the EU. So what I'm saying is Priti Patel, she might be right that people, generally speaking, want an end to freedom of movement at some point. But if she thinks that an authoritarian instinct and we want to shut the gates instantly and we don't care what happens to people, she's really wrong on that. And I think she'll be taught a lesson.
Okay. Now, you mentioned there, Brandon, democratic institutions and British democratic institutions. Would you agree with me that the House of Commons is the fulcrum of that?
Yes. So, ideally.
So here comes the qualification. What I'm leading to here is the willingness, and in fact, in Johnson's case, the eagerness to actually cut the House of Commons and the Parliament out of the decision-making process, because he fears, quite rightly, that he doesn't have within that. The British Prime Minister does not have the support of the House of Commons in a decision that is probably the most important since the one taken by the British government in 1939, yeah?
Yes. I have something I really want to say on this.
Please
which is,
do, yeah. Well, my question is, if democratic institutions and British ones are your primary concern, and they should be, and justifiably, what about the House of Commons and Brexit?
Yeah, I am opposed to proroguing Parliament. So I think Boris Johnson's plans to prorogue Parliament, you know, that is to kind of shut Parliament down so that they can't stop him from enacting no deal, I think that's wrong. I don't want the Queen involved in politics. I don't want the monarch shutting down Parliament so that anything can be pushed through.
Oh, Prince Andrew, I hope.
Oh, Prince Andrew or any of that crowd. I'm not interested. You know, we fought a civil war in England to get the monarch out of politics, and I don't think we should be bringing her back now. But the key point I would make is, you know, all these parliamentarians, and we know that parliamentarians are a huge majority of them voted Remain. They are very hostile to Brexit. A lot of them want to just stop Brexit entirely. The thing is that these supposed rebels in Parliament, they present themselves as standing up against an overreaching executive, i.e. the Boris government, and they present themselves as defending parliamentary democracy. But I just don't buy that. I think fundamentally what they're standing up against is the votes of millions and millions of people to leave the European Union. And they are defending Parliament not from an undemocratic executive, but from a massive democratic vote. And there was an absolutely fascinating YouGov poll the other week, which I think summed up Brexit Britain absolutely perfectly. It asked MPs and ordinary members of the public, what was the role of an MP? Should an MP pursue his or her own beliefs, even if they run counter to their constituents' beliefs, or should they act on behalf of their constituents, even if it goes against their own beliefs? And the results are astonishing. A massive majority of MPs, over 80%, said we have to act on our own beliefs, even if our constituents don't like it. And a massive majority of ordinary people, more than 60%, said they have to do as we instruct them, even if they don't like it. And I thought that absolutely captured the divide that exists in the UK right now, which is between a parliament which thinks it's its responsibility to lead the people in the correct direction, and ordinary people who are saying, listen, we want a more direct form of democracy. You have to do what we tell you. So I don't buy the idea that this is parliament versus the executive. I think fundamentally it's parliament versus the people.
Just to look more broadly, Brandon, at the government's behaviour, the Johnson government's behaviour, for example, on law and order, or what used to be called law and order, this absurd thing. They've been in office 9 years, this Tory party. They've cut the police force by 22,000. They've made everything worse in terms of cuts. They could be reasonably, I think, held to be responsible for the violence and the fear that's stalking British streets, and one can see it in shocking events like the murder of that police constable on Friday. Now, Johnson's going around doing photo ops. I saw him in a prison punching the air, walking along beside the cells. He cuts a preposterous figure. and everyone is laughing at them. Gove yesterday. Then you have Priti Patel. And they are lashing out all these press releases, these photo ops, with all of this reactionary tosh that you know, goes back to the 50s, some of it, and is slightly, well, whatever. It's mad stuff. They look stupid to the rest of the world. Is there any sense of that in it? I mean, you're in London. You know, it's a cosmopolitan place, the civilized, beautiful city. You're a young guy. Are these buffoons seeming like statesmen?
No. They, in their own minds, I'm sure they think they do seem like statesmen, but to most people, they don't. And I think you're right to raise the example of their law and order program, because they are responsible for the cutting of police numbers and for, you know, the absence of bobbies on the beat.
Yeah.
And, you know, London is a very strange place at the moment. I mean, it is largely a safe city. You can go out at night. It's all fine. But there has been a rise in certain forms of violent crime and gang behavior and so on. You know, people like my mother don't really like to go out after 5 p.m. They don't feel safe. And the one thing that people always say is, if there were a couple of police officers walking up and down my local high street all day long, which is what they used to do in the past, people would feel a lot safer. The problem is, as you say, the Tories cut so many institutions' budgets that there isn't the money for some of those kinds of things. So their promises now to get a grip on law and order and to make Britain a kind of more secure, more safe country actually ring quite hollow with yes. many people. And they also sound authoritarian. You know, people might want the streets to be yes. safer, and they might want to see a few more policemen walking up and down and you know, telling idiots to go home, but they don't necessarily want people put in jail for years and years and years, and they don't want everyone locked up, and they don't want the country to become one big open prison. So the Tories are getting that balance completely wrong at the moment, I would say.
And just a final question, Brendan, about the equally wretched Jeremy Corbyn.
Oh my goodness.
No, it's kind of, for someone like me who lived in Britain for 17 years, who loves the English really, and appreciates some of the wonderful elements or aspects of British life and what Britain has given to the world, to watch this is rather sad, really.
Yes.
And the Labour Party is finished, it seems to me. They seem to think they're finished. They look like they're finished. And I think you and I have discussed this before. It looks like the two-party system. The Tories are on the brink of it, aren't they? You know, how can you reconcile a buffoon like Johnson with someone like Ken Clark or someone of his disposition? I mean, I know you probably don't like Clark because he's an ardent Europhile, but he was a man of some substance and intelligence.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about the Labour Party. They do come across as increasingly wretched. I mean, particularly Corbyn. You know, I think Jeremy Corbyn is the least principled man in British politics, which is really ironic.
Some competition.
Yeah, and there's stiff competition for that. And people used to say that, you know, the one thing you can say about Jeremy Corbyn is he has strong beliefs and he sticks to them. We now know that is completely and utterly untrue. Yes. This is a man who was a Eurosceptic for his entire political life. He followed in the footsteps of great left-wing Eurosceptics like Tony Benn and Barbara Castle and Peter Shaw. He's now abandoned all of that entirely. And even worse, he's basically pleading with the political class to make him the caretaker the caretaker prime minister of an unelected government, which would shunt Boris to one side, prevent Brexit from going through and holding a second referendum. So he has sold out everything he ever believed, and is now he wants to be a tool of the elite against the people. I think yeah. it is the most shameful display in contemporary British politics, and that's really saying something. More broadly, I think you're right. The two-party system just cannot hold anymore. I mean, it's bursting at the seams.
Yes.
There are other parties just bursting to get out of the Labour Party and bursting to get out of the Tory Party. What I'm hoping is that the introduction of the Brexit Party and even the success of the Lib Dems, who I don't like particularly, I think that the growth of those parties, I hope, will finally break apart the two-party system, ease the tensions within those parties, and allow the creation of other political organisations. I think that's one of the things that would help politics in this country.
Okay, Brendan, as always, fascinating to talk to you. I'm very grateful to you. That's Brendan O'Neill, the editor of Spiked Online. And we're very grateful to Brendan for his contributions to The Stand. We'd like to thank him, all of you for listening. That's all we have time for. We'll talk to you soon.